Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IGO Protections Policy Development Process Working Group call on Wednesday, 16 January. On the call today we have Wilson Abigaba, Donna Austin, Len Riaji, Alain Béranger, Avery Doria, Elizabeth Finberg, Chuck Gomes, Alan Greenberg, Stephen Hankins, David Mayer, David Opperbeck, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickert, Greg Chetan, Claudia McMaster-Tamarit, who will be able to attend only for the first hour, Mary Wong, Mason Cole. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Brian Peck, and myself, Julia Chavelin. And we have apologies from Ilya Bazlyankov and David Roach-Turner. May I remind all participants to please state their name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Julia. This is Thomas Rickert speaking, and I'm the chair of this working group. And I'd like to ask the group whether there are any statements, any updates to the statements of interest. Hearing none, we can move to the next agenda item, and that is the status of the General Counsel request. And as usual, I'd like to ask you, Brian, to give us an update on that, please.
Thank you, Thomas. This is Brian Peck from ICANN staff. I checked with the General Counsel's office earlier today. They wanted to provide a brief update on the status of their work. They are continuing to coordinate the research among counsel in multiple jurisdictions. And to be honest, has turned into a larger project than they first expected. They are trying to address the specific questions posed, and as I said, working with multiple jurisdiction councils, and plan to provide an update on the expected delivery date as soon as one's available.
Okay, thank you, Brian, which allows us to go to the next agenda item number 3, which hasn't been on the agenda that you received by email. I see Avery's hand up. Avery, please.
Yes, I just have a quick question. So we're going to, at some point, get a projection on when the date for receiving the answers is. Do we have a projection on when we might get that projection?
thanks, Avery. This is Brian. I asked that as well. They weren't prepared at this time to that. They realize the urgency of the issue, and as I said, I think it's gotten to be a bigger project than they originally expected. So they are working as hard as they can to get it as completed as soon as possible. But that's as much as I was able to glean from them today, at least.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your question, Avery, and thanks, Brian, for answering it. I'm sure that Brian will keep us in the loop as soon as he gets some more substantial feedback from General Counsel. Now, as regards the newly introduced agenda item number 3, I have given Alan Greenberg a heads up earlier. Since we are now discussing the status of the responses to our input request, and the only written statement that we received so far is the statement from Alec, and I'd very much like to invite Alan to show us through the main points of this statement, because after having read it, I think there are a couple of points in there that could inform and stimulate our discussion on the spreadsheet later on. Alan, over to you.
Thank you very much. First, note that there were two versions sent to the working group. One was the final version, and one was not quite the final version, and they came in the reverse order. The one that is the correct one came directly from me. I also provided a direct link to it in an email today, and it's the one with a short preamble paragraph before I start going into the questions themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the one on the screen is the right one. It is the right one.
Alan, before you proceed, I see that Barry's hands up. Barry, would you like to say something now or wait for Alan to have finished?
Hi, Thomas. This is Barry. Thank you. Just real quick, I'd like to just advise the working group that yesterday was the deadline for input requests from the SOs, ACs, SGs, and Cs. We did send out another email to each of the chairs of those organizations advising them and asking if they will be providing additional input. We didn't apply a new deadline date, but we're hoping to at least receive responses as to whether these groups intend to send anything in, and hopefully we'll receive other feedback from the groups as soon as possible for use by the working group. And just one other point, the registry stakeholder group did say that they are working on their response as well, and I don't recall the exact date, but I believe maybe next week in the rough time frame as to when that may be available for review as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. That's certainly very helpful. So just for you to bear in mind, go back to your respective groups, and should you wish to respond to the request for input, please do so as soon as you can, and we will make sure that we incorporate the feedback and consider it as we move along. But we thought that for, since time is of essence, that we shouldn't give another one, two, or whatever the amount of weeks should be for people to respond, because we thought that would unduly hold up the train. Greg, do you have an intervention related to this?
Yes, I just wanted to orally confirm that the IPC is preparing responses, and I think the next week time frame, conceivably this week, but I'd rather underpromise and overdeliver than the reverse. But I would think that IPC should have its comments response in next week. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. That's good news. And unless there are more interventions or hands up to comment on the general approach or to announce more feedback, I'd like to hand over to you, Alan, to give us Mason. I see Mason. Please.
Yes. Thanks, Thomas. Just to let you know, the registrars will have their reply in the next few days as well.
That's good news. Thank you. Thank you, Mason.
This is Robin Gross. Can I get in the queue real quick?
Sure.
I just wanted to let you know the non-commercial stakeholder group is also working on its response, and we'll have it to you within the next few days.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robin. And now, Alan, please.
Should I wait for the next interruption? All right. I'm not going to this is a long statement, and I'm not going to try to read it verbatim. I'm just going to try to hit the high spots and hope I remember them. The preamble essentially reiterates what I said at the last meeting, that blocking in within the domain name system is a rather strong action, one that we have refrained from taking in the past in most cases. And the at-large feels it's exceedingly important that if we're going to do this, we understand why we're going to do it, and we understand and that we have some belief that it's going to fix the problems that are perceived. And I will be following up with an email on some of the specifics that I think this work group can do to try to hit that target. In terms of the questions, the first one asked about what kinds of entities should receive special protections at the top and second levels. We do not believe that there is any need for a top-level protection. If the objection processes that are in place should be more than sufficient to address any real harm that could be done through this, and if indeed the four current objections do not meet that target, then I think that's an indication that we need a specific type of objection for the next round to make sure. But to block names universally does not seem to be reasonable, and I think we need to make sure that our processes make sure that names are protected, but not simply by putting them on a forbidden list to begin with. We'll be going into some detail on this later. At the second level, it's far more complex because we don't have a long, complex, drawn-out objection process and evaluation process for second-level names. And I'm presuming, by the way, that second level means the level at which registrations are taken, which is third level in some cases. We feel pretty strongly that second-level protection, if it's going to be taken, has to be taken because it's addressing a real problem, and that it addresses it by fixing it. And we have not seen a lot of evidence of the kinds of problems and the kinds of harm that we're talking about in the exact match world that we're looking at. And there's plenty of evidence that, certainly anecdotal evidence, that this is not the case. So, again, we're looking for, if there's going to be second-level protection, we need to make sure that it's done for a reason and we understand it. Question two was looking at...
Alan, sorry. Before you move to the next question, Chuck, did you have a question regarding Alan's intervention so far?
Thanks, Thomas. I did with regard to the preamble. In particular, Alan, you mentioned, you talked about blocking. Are you using blocking synonymously with reserving names?
Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah, but, I mean, reserving names essentially says you're not going to allow anyone to register them ever. And I think the two are synonymous.
Thank you.
No, I've been using the term blocking specifically because we've had long debates in various groups about whether we should call it reservation or limited reservation or, you know, we've played around with the name for that. And I didn't want to try to use it a technical name which might have specific meanings that are narrower than the general concept.
But, Alan, I think that's a very helpful clarification because, as you will surely know, the term blocking is used for different scenarios in the DNS as well.
I think certainly within ICANN we specialize in having at least three or four meanings for every word. So I'm not pretending, and I've avoided that here. I was just trying to avoid one problem and probably generated another. The question two talks about treaties, and our comment is relatively short, that we believe if we're going to block names, reserve names, whatever, based on treaty and national laws, that the treaties must explicitly say the names are protected, and that must be backed up by the national laws, and there must be a significant number of national laws that do this. And I'm not going to play the game of saying 33 is not enough, but 37 is, or setting whatever the threshold is. Clearly, in our minds, three or four is not sufficient. 150 would be impressive. You know, so we're talking about that kind of measure. Exactly where the demarcation is not clear. But, you know, if we're going to use treaties and national laws, then they must actually offer the protection that we're saying they do. We do not believe ICANN should be in the world of generating brand-new protections that don't exist anywhere else. We're in a rather privileged position of dictating global use of terms, and forbidding global use of terms is an onerous issue. Okay, three. We believe, as said in the previous one, if we're going to use treaties and national laws, then it has to be, you know, a substance body of legislation or treaties that indicate it. We, however, believe we don't need that, and we understand that the train has left on the treaty and national law direction, and because of GAC advice, we're not likely to drop that. But nevertheless, we do not believe it's really necessary. We believe that protection should be granted based on the merits of particular cases, that it should not be universally granted to a wide class of organizations, that protection should be granted because there's evidence of harm or potential harm, and there is a strong argument that the public interest is served by offering this protection. And the document goes into some specifics. And particularly that the harms should be harms to the public interest or to the organization, but they should be significant harms. And an organization, for instance, which doesn't have a real persona on the Internet other than having a couple of explanatory web pages, doesn't interact with users, you know, doesn't collect money, doesn't have other activities going on with users, is certainly going to be less prone to fraud issues than an organization which does have those characteristics, and we think any policy we come out with should be cognizant of those issues. Question four is, are there differences between the Red Cross, IOC, and IGOs? We feel very strongly there are differences. There's a difference between between the Red Cross and the IOC, and certainly IGOs come in many, many flavors. And more important, we feel that there are IGOs that are not protected by treaty, and now we're talking about the, you know, how we're going to interpret the charter words, that we feel there are organizations that are worthy of protection which don't have treaty protection. So there's a lot of different flavors in these kind of things. Three, we believe, was already addressed, or five, rather, in, should the protections be at the top level, at top and second level. Six, again, is we've reiterated that we believe there should be protections under certain terms, but they shouldn't be granted across the board. Then question seven said, should the current protections that are in place or the ones that might be in place, should they be maintained? And we believe they do not fit the model that we were talking about and should not be maintained. And lastly, do we feel that the existing right protection mechanisms are sufficient? And our answer to that is no. Certainly for IGOs which cannot use the UDRP at all right now because they are not trademarks, and there was significant discussion in ICANN about providing a separate or a modified process for them that we didn't go forward on. That's a position that we this work group, I do not think, can leave. We have to make sure that the existing right protections are available in one form or another to all the organizations we're talking about. And we may be in a situation where the right protection mechanisms, which were largely designed many, many years ago and have generally been maintained through the new GTLD process, are not sufficient. And in which case, I think we need to look at it on a general case, not only for these organizations, but, you know, making sure that the Internet is a healthy place for corporations and governmental organizations to exist. And we have one last note, which is out of scope for this project, for this working group, but we believe that anything that we recommend, ICANN should advocate, cannot legislate, but should advocate for CCTLDs, because if it's important in GTLDs, it should be equally important in CCTLDs. And that's a quick summary. I'll certainly be willing to take questions now or when people have had a time to read it more carefully and digest it.
That's most welcome. Thank you very much, Alan. Are there any questions for Alan?
Yes, this is Wolfgang. Do you make a difference between intergovernmental organizations and non-governmental organizations? And what is your position to the recommendation in the GAC advice to use the .in criteria for defining what an intergovernmental organization is?
If the group were to end up saying that we want to grant global protection to a large class of IGOs, then having a list that the GAC derives based on the .int specification is a reasonable way to go. However, we do not believe that we should be granting global protection to large number of organizations without some evidence that indeed we're fixing a problem, or that it's a problem that needs fixing, or that is a problem and that it will fix it. And we haven't seen the evidence of that. If there is sufficient evidence of it, then yes, that's a reasonable way to go. But based on what we know right now, no, we do not think that we should be going that way.
Okay, thanks, Alan.
But it's a two-pronged question. That if we go that way, yes, that's a reasonable path to take to get to the end.
Okay, thank you, Wolfgang, for the question and Alan for the answer. Are there more questions for Alan, I see Chuck's hand up. Please, Chuck.
Thanks, Thomas, and thanks, Alan, for the very effective summary. I know you guys have the ALAC members as well as at-large people have probably talked about this question a lot, but it's a critical question in the direction I think that the ALAC is recommending. How do we measure harm, or how do we measure worthiness? Those are challenging questions, and as you know, the new GTLD recommendations really emphasize being able to develop objective, measurable criteria and avoid subjective decisions as much as possible. We talked about this a little bit on the call last week in terms of measuring worthiness. You have any response with regard to those questions?
Yes, we do. It's not a wholly satisfactory response, I'll grant you. Following those kind of guidelines to the letter, I think, will end up with us either recommending not protecting and blocking names which really do warrant protection, or granting protections to a very wide number of character strings where there is really no defensible reason to do it other than that's the path we took. Tough. We couldn't come up with anything that was more fine-grained than that. We believe there is going to have to be some objective decision-making if we're going to do this without going into the concept of blocking on a very wide level. Because I have no illusions. If we do this for a large number of IGOs, they're not going to be the last ones to get in line saying we want it too. So I think we're starting on a path that we don't want to go down. So, yes, I think, and we think, that there is going to have to be some subjectivity involved. It is up to this work group and the implementers after it to try to put some words in place which describe what we're talking about, and then you're going to need to go to some outside panel. It's not going to be a judgment of ICANN staff that will evaluate the applications and make judgments on it. And, you know, with an appeal process and things like that if necessary, there are plenty of learned, knowledgeable people around who can make those kind of judgments. Courts of law make judgments all the time. All sorts of bodies make judgments, based on wording, and then they have a subjective view of them. And I think this is a situation where we're going to have to do the same thing.
Thanks, Alan. I have Alain now.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Thomas. I wanted to reiterate the feeling that that there seem to be different levels of privilege considered for governments versus NGOs. In that sense, the second point I would make is that the onus to demonstrate the needs for protection should go to the applicant or to any organization that requests special protection. So therefore, I'm in agreement with the suggestion made that we would need a process where we can make a judgment on the validity of the request. And going back to the first point, I think making sure we have we care about the delicate balance between public, private, and civil society organizations is more critical than ever at ICANN. At least I believe that, and I sense that it's not always the case, and I wouldn't want to go with this in a direction where IGOs, it's easier for IGOs to demonstrate the need for protection than it is for INGOs. Thanks.
Thanks, Alain.
Can I reply?
Who's that?
It's Alan speaking.
Alan, please.
Yeah, I support what Alain says completely. The the situation right now is we are in a position if we follow ahead on the direction that some people have indicated they want to go, and certainly the GAC was, we are going to point blank give protection to a large number of IGOs with no evidence that they need it at all, and absolutely refuse it to a large number of NGOs that could probably demonstrate the merits and their need for it. And that's exactly the opposite to where I believe we should be going, and I think Alain was supporting that direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alain, I see Chuck's hand up. I don't know whether it's an old hand or
it
a new hand.
Not.
Chuck.
Thanks, Thomas. It's a follow-up to Alan Greenberg's answer to my previous question. Alan, did the ALAC try to apply its recommended criteria, the need criterion, to the INT names as recommended by the GAC for IGOs? And if so, is it your expectation that all of those would apply, or just some subset, or none? I don't know if you can respond to that or not.
Well, I can't give you a definitive answer, and we haven't done a careful study. In the email that I did promise, going into a little bit more on some metrics and the concept of fact-based decision-making, I will go into a little bit more detail with a couple of examples. And I admit they're going to be examples that are easy picking. They're low-hanging fruit because they were so easy to analyze. But they demonstrate that, it's not clear there are harms right now. And it's not clear that there are harms that people need to fix. Now, we don't know what the new GTLD world is going to be like. I haven't even seen an analysis, maybe there is one somewhere, of how many of the prospective new GTLDs are really going to be open for general registration without strong qualifications as to who is eligible. I haven't seen the count of that. I assume it's more than a few hundred and probably under 500, but that would be an interesting number because it really tells us the magnitude of the group we're looking at. So, yes, we have talked about it. We have not done any great analysis. You will see a bit of very rudimentary examples, not analysis, in what I'll be sending out to the group later on. But, yes, the current IGO list is a mixed bag of a lot of different things.
Thank you.
And thanks, Chuck and Alan. Now, that leads us smoothly to the fourth agenda item, which is the review of the work packages spreadsheet. And you will have noted that we have been talking about evidence of harms, and I think that easily translates to the nature of the problem spreadsheet, and that is also the reason why I invited Alan to describe a little bit what the how they came up with their statement and what the main points of their statements were, because as regards the nature of the problem spreadsheet and also when we come to the qualification criteria later on, I think that the Alex statement, and I'm sure that this will be the same for other statements that we're going to hopefully receive in the coming days, actually stimulates questions that haven't been asked specifically in the same manner. And, reminding us that ICANN has been quite hesitant to grant special protections, and bearing in mind that Chuck has also provided us with some historical data on the PDP, where RPMs were asked for, but then in the Reserved Names Working Group there was this intentional discussion not to go beyond what the recommendations were. I think the question that we might ask ourselves is, have we asked the right question for the nature of the problem spreadsheet, or do we need to refine that a little bit? Alain Béranger just said a couple of minutes ago that the burden is on those that are requesting protections to provide some sort of fact base for that. I think that I would phrase it a little bit broader, namely that in the light of the history that Chuck and others reported to us, I think we need to make upfront, and maybe this is the reason why it is the first spreadsheet in the Excel file, we need to determine first whether there is an issue that needs fixing. And my question is, and I'm really having difficulty answering that that question, is what more data or evidence should we be asking those that are requesting protection to provide us with, to give us a sufficient fact base to actually make a determination whether that is sufficient harm or not. And I quote from the ALEC paper, it reads, "We need to make sure that there are real harms if we do not so, and that the protections will in fact prohibit such harms. At the moment, we have little evidence of such harms, particularly for IGOs, and we have little evidence that protecting exact matches only will be of significant help." So I'd like to ask those that are representing potential beneficiaries of this work to maybe give us the most critical point that they would like to derive their protection from. Because, you know, if you look at the spreadsheet, what you see is that the mere costs of defensive registrations are very very much debated or controversial, but maybe there are other points that we can introduce that where more common ground can be found, or not, depending on what the points may be. So I'd like to open the floor to the working group participants to spell out what their primary concern or parameter to evidence harm might be. I see Alan. Alan, please.
Yeah, I'm going to give an example in the outside of the world we're looking at. I did a check, and I don't remember the exact number, but I did a check of the number of registrations that Microsoft owns. And it's some number, 300,000, 500,000. It's a lot. And I've got to believe, although I haven't seen the definitive list of all of those, that many, many, many of those are not exact names, but are typos and are names used in conjunction with other things. And my gut feeling is that that's the case for the kinds of organizations we're looking at also. I certainly know it is because of the examples the Olympic International Olympic Committee gave to the previous drafting group, and I've seen similar ones from the Red Cross, that the protections we're talking about are just the tip of the iceberg. And although I have absolutely no qualm with the statement saying defensive registrations are expensive, it's not clear to me, in any case, that this is going to change the situation markedly. So I think that's the kind of thing that we need to look at, not just the global statement that defensive registrations are expensive. That's true. But it's not clear that what we're looking at is going to fix that. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And maybe to elaborate a little bit more on the scenario, what I've seen, and this is closely related to the protection spreadsheet, I think what we need to focus on as we move along is to determine what special harms there might be between the current status, i.e. the status with the new RPMs introduced, and the absence of the outcome of this PDP, or the absence of new protections. And what jumps to mind is the gap between reactive and proactive. So you may remember that there has been criticism by those requesting protections that the RPMs as they stand would only be reactive, while they would need proactive protection. So we would need to look at the proactive side as a starting point and then work on what harms are caused to the organizations. And maybe the points are already in the spreadsheet. Maybe financial damages are the primary concern. But what I'd like to hear from the group is what points or what, you know, if it's a quantitative point, how can we approach this in order to make a determination? Or alternatively, are there any points in this list that you think are not helping our discussion so that maybe we can remove it from the list? But I think that as we move on, now that we've officially declared the fact-finding mission closed, I think the primary arguments that have been made are on the table, and we need to prioritize them and hopefully cut some out so that we can shortlist the ones that are more relevant and then gather supporting evidence from the affected organizations. Maybe you don't have an answer, but maybe you have a statement or comment on the question that I've asked. You know, I'm not
Thomas, it's Alan. Kieran asked the question in the chat you may want to look at.
Just reading it. Yeah, I think that, for those who are not on the Adobe, let me read out Kieran's comment. Thomas, are you asking the IOC and the other organizations present to make a statement about why we think we need protection, even if it's just for exact matches? And yes, that is the question. I'd like to get some views and enter into a discussion with you what your primary concern is. And if we learn as a group what the primary concern is, then we might be able to find appropriate quantitative parameters where we can ask you to provide us with more basic facts to learn whether there is a real harm or actually a problem. Because, Kieran, as you mentioned, exact matches, looking at the charter, we are looking at names and acronyms of organizations. So the task that we've been mandated with is looking at exact matches to the names and the acronyms.
Thomas?
Jim, please go ahead.
I just want to say we have tried to do that in the comments that we have prepared and filed yesterday. We can try to go into more depth in response, but I think the primary thing that, I can't speak for all the organizations, but I think all the organizations that seek protection are viewing this as a diversion of resources, diversion of funds, as well as time and effort, against cyber squatting and phishing and other types of wrongdoing by domain name registrants, and that's the primary harm, that funds that could be used or would be used for public good are being diverted toward trying to go after people who are wrongfully registering domains that will likely lead to confusion, fraud, or other damages.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I certainly saw that you commented in a lot of fields. However, what I'd like to learn, and hopefully the other working group participants are also eager to learn this from you and from the other organizations' representatives, is, you may make comments to many points, But I think what we need to do is sort of a ranking. And maybe there's common ground that, you know, financial disadvantages, let me put it that way, are the top priority issue that we need to look at. And maybe we can then neglect or completely delete from the list other points that have been made, because even you as the affected organizations don't regard them as being decisive. So as a follow-up question, the financial damage incurred with the IOC is your primary motivation to request special protections. Is that correct? I'm just reading that Kieran, Jim, and David got cut off, so let me ask Stefan to comment. Stefan, you had your hand up, please.
Yes, thank you very much. Stefan Hankins, International Committee of the Red Cross and Red Cross Red Crescent Movement. Yes, I'd like to... Well, first of all, of course, each organization has a different case to be made, but I think it's a little bit misleading, and this is reflected also in this table, really to simply reduce the issue to the financial damage question. I mean, at the base of this, it's a reputation prejudice that we're looking at. And then, of course, flows from that the need for the organizations concerned and the need for international law to protect these designations. To me, the square in the table that counts really is probably the last one, which is the public good, global public interest dimension. And, of course, you know, that will be assessed in different ways for different organizations. But, I mean, if I will take the case of the Red Cross, Red Crescent designations here, obviously, you know, the protection under public international law and these universally agreed Geneva Conventions, I mean, what they intend to do is to protect these designations. These are intrinsic protections. The purpose of this is dual. One of them is related, and I'm going to repeat myself again, it's related to the protective function of the emblems that are designated by these names in armed conflict, protective emblems of the medical services of armed forces. The assumption is that if these names are misused, including in peacetime, or associated to purposes or other organizations which do not work and do not abide by the values that these emblems and these designations represent, that this will damage the protective function of the emblems themselves. That's number one. Then there is the indicative function of the emblems and the designations, which there relates more clearly also to the object of this working group, which is designations of specific organizations. And here, of course, the concern is that the designations of the organizations concerned, I mean here the organizations that are part of the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement, that the reputation of these organizations not be damaged by misuse of the designations by organizations which do not share the same values and the same fundamental principles by which we seek to abide. It's clearly a reputation issue, and the law is very, very clear. If you look at international law, the purpose is to protect the reputation, the image, and the functions of these designations. That's where the public good lies, and I think that's the prism that we have to look at. The question of the fun, you know, of the financial consequences for the organizations concerned to fight it out, and which is shared by all. We share, I think, all organizations share the reputation concern. They share, you know, the concern of the costs involved. But I think the basics, what we're looking at, is the global public interest. And that's the primary consideration. Of course, there are financial costs, and of course, we're putting them forward. But, you know, let's look at, it's the last square that counts. Thank you very much. This is what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Stefan. Before I move to Kieran and Jim, let me ask you a follow-up question. So if my understanding is correct, and you've been using different terminology here, I'd just like to have absolute clarity on that. Your top priority would be the public good. You then mentioned the global public good. I think the essence of what you said is referring to the global public good, including the reputation of the organizations, or would you see the global public good and the reputation as two separate parameters that should be looked at?
Well, to me, global public good, I in my mind, equals this concept that I think is familiar to the ICANN processes, which is the global public interest concept, right? I think, as I said, if we just look at the Red Cross, Red Crescent, you know, case, I mean, the global public interest, to me, you know, it is the rationale for the international protection in the first place. Is two things. There's the protection of the protective functions of the emblems and their designations in armed conflict. So here we have a direct and very unique case, because here we're talking about designations of emblems that have, you know, a direct bearing on the protection in armed conflicts. You know, it's really at the heart of the international law rules we're talking about, which are enshrined in the Geneva Convention. That's number one. And then there's the reputation question, which of course, you know, is also very central, because if you just take the Red Cross, Red Crescent organizations, they enjoy an international mandate under international humanitarian law to provide assistance and protection to victims, etc. So, you know, it's a dual public interest in this instance. I don't know if I've answered your question.
I guess you have, and you will find out in a moment, because my proposal is that we add to the table two points, one of which is the global public interest, and another one being the reputation of the organization, and then let the group comment on that. You know, this is just to make sure that we know your top priorities, and I take good note that this is of top priority for the RCRC, and that financial considerations would rank lower on the priority list. Ellen, before I move to you, I have Kieran.
Thomas, can I get in the queue? It's Claudia.
Yes, you can. I have Kieran now, then Ellen, and then Claudia.
Thomas, this is Stefan Hankins. Can I just say one word?
Yes, please.
I did not mean to say that it ranks lower. I don't want to provide a hierarchy of our concerns. My comment was essentially directed to identify the global public interest. But of course, you know, the other squares in the table are as relevant to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan. Kieran?
It's Jim.
Jim, sorry. Please go ahead.
All right, I was just going to say we got cut off when you asked the question, and I think I didn't want to give the impression that we're talking about financial interest. We're talking about diversion of funds that would be used for public interest going to enforcement measures. But I don't think that's the most important. I think in ranking these things, I think the legal protection, whether by treaty or national laws, would be the first and most important from, I think, our standpoint. The second being, as Stefan said, and we agree with that, the reputation and also the public interest points. So I just wanted to make clear the financial is part of diversion of resources, because if you get $100 and you have to put it into cease and desist letters, et cetera, instead of devoting it to some environmental cause in Gambia, then that's something that is against the public interest, I think.
Thanks, Jim. Let me maybe clarify. I would separate the discussion surrounding the nature of the problem or the existence of a problem, as Alec mentioned it in their statement, from the question of legal protections. I'm not saying that, you know, that this is a point that I would personally find decisive, but having followed this discussion for quite some time, this is a question that is being asked by the community. And the question is there a real problem that we're solving? And even if there were treaty protections, and I know that I'm paraphrasing now, even if there were treaty protections, but if there were no threat scenario at all for the organizations being granted these protections, I think that wouldn't be, or that might not be, good enough reason for the community to grant extra protections.
Hi, Thomas, this is Kieran. Can I just clarify our point very quickly? I just wanted to say that we believe the violation of national laws is part of the problem. So while we understand that examining what the laws protect and the scope, et cetera, it falls squarely under qualification criteria, we also believe that a violation of a national law, which has been enacted to address some of the other harms that are in the nature of the problem spreadsheet, is in and of itself a harm that this group should address.
Thank you, Kieran. That's a helpful clarification. But I hope you understand why I'm bringing up this question, because I think that we need to to inform the community about the threat scenario and why we are, or at least the question has been asked, what are we trying to solve and what's the problem? I have Alan next and then Claudia.
Thank you. I think the last speakers have demonstrated just how complex this problem is. I understand, Stefan, we're going over the mandate of, you know, why the Red Cross has treaty protection, but I don't think anyone's going to argue with those things. But the question that might come up is, but does having a website with the name Red Cross in it harm the battlefield protection of soldiers? You know, and you know, what is the direct link? Kieran's recent statement that if something is protected in national law, that it follows directly that we should be stopping domain name use for it. Well, there are many countries that outlaw so many things. You know, to use the classic example of .xxx, you know, we should have banned that a long time ago because it's outlawed in some countries. And there's a whole bunch of objections on new GTLDs that some countries have said, but we have laws against it, therefore maybe you shouldn't have that at all. So it's the linkage between all these things that is far from clear, and I think we need to try to build a logical argument for why we jump from protection of a word in three countries to why we should be outlawing it globally. And in my mind, and I'm not speaking on behalf of ALAC, although I suspect they would agree, these connections are not easy to make. So thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I have Claudia and then Elizabeth.
Hi, Thomas. Just to answer the question about what is the harm that we seek to protect, I think from the viewpoint of some INGOs that are looking at the future of new utilities rolling out, and there being possibly thousands and if not millions of domain abuse situations in second levels and in third levels and possibly in top levels further on down the road, the risk for them is very much at the heart of what they do. In other words, organizations that were, by their very mandate, by their very composition, the purpose that they exist, the reason why they have national, international recognition to do international work, is that they have been structured and supported financially sometimes, much more than just finances, but by international participation, to address a particular issue or a particular policy-making area. If all of a sudden these organizations have to now decide, well, either we devote more funds and more resources, more personnel from our organization to fight these domain abuses, we might find ourselves in a position of being swallowed up by this kind of an activity, or then risking then great harm to our reputation. So I think that the public interest is absolutely at the heart of this question from some INGOs' perspectives. It's true that diverting public funds or funds that have been dedicated to the public interest is obviously a natural consequence of organizations having to then protect their reputation, a reputation that can serve the public in even their day-to-day tasks. So the financial part is an aspect of it, but it's also very much a reputational part, and it's also very much a mandate aspect. Organizations that have been created to serve a public interest are not poised to have to go after domain name enforcement for abuses of their names and acronyms. So we really sort of lie in a conundrum here. Do we end up attempting to divert significant resources to protecting our reputation at the risk of then suddenly finding ourselves well outside of our mandate? It's a very sort of precarious situation. What happens is that the organization itself sort of finds itself at risk, and it finds itself in a sort of a between a rock and a hard place kind of. I hope that made sense. I apologize. It's a bit of a complicated day over here.
Sure, Claudia. One quick follow-up question. Would you see the global public good that you have referred to and the mandate as two separate issues, or would the mandate be the global public good?
Yeah, I think that we have to look at the specific mandate. I think that's one of the comments that we've talked about is this case-by-case analysis. We have to look at the specific mandate. Organizations have different ones. And some organizations, some INGOs, for example, have a mandate that is to serve the public good, and we can see that evidenced in how their work can affect absolutely every aspect of our lives, from consumer protection to products, safety to trade barriers being brought down. So depending on an organization, under a case-by-case analysis, if their mandate is to serve the public good, and we might look at that by looking at how many countries does that organization serve, what kind of an impact does their work have on an international level, what kind of, this is where we're getting into more of the criteria, yes? But we can answer that question of what is your mandate? Okay, your mandate is to serve a public interest. Okay, that means that your organization is structured to handle that. It's not like a trademark corporation, a trademark owner that's a private corporation that can, pass on its cost to the consumer. That's structured in a way to take on this sort of overhead. Organizations like INGOs that are meant to and structured to serve the public good, they're not structured to deal with this proliferating domain name abuse as the internet continues to expand.
Thanks for that clarification, Claudia. I have Elizabeth Finberg next.
Hi, Elizabeth Finberg, PIR. I wanted to sort of follow up to your what I think was one of your early questions, Thomas, which I think goes to the heart of what we're being asked to do, and that is to address a real existing harm to see if we can reach consensus about whether there really is a problem, and then how do we address it. And I think when Jim was speaking, and he said, well, you know, if we have an organization like the IOC that has $100 that they could, you know, spend to serve the public good, but instead they're spending it on cease and desist orders, I would be very interested to see the empirical data that would help us, to inform us and help us to evaluate that and to make that a part of our deliberative process here. And somewhat on the same note, with respect to Claudia's remarks, I think if we're talking about prospective harm, we're really on a slippery slope in terms of what could we do to the internet to protect against any eventuality. And the answer is, you know, we're never going to be able to come up with something that's going to protect against every possible harm. We can only evaluate what is real and then, you know, respond with our recommendations accordingly. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Kieran.
Thomas, it's Jim.
Jim.
I want to just say that in my belief, I think Elizabeth's point is very good. I think that, and I'm not saying that it should be just the laws and then, reputation and diversion of resources. I think there has to be some harm that's shown, because otherwise every organization would claim that it's entitled to protection, special protection. I think the question is, how do you show harm? And I think one of the best ways to show harm is what's happened in the existing 22 TLDs. Everything else is speculative. We don't know what's going to happen with the addition of whether it's 500 or 800, whether there's going to be harm for the first time to some organizations or not. And I think by showing what's happened now before the introduction of the new GTLDs is an indication of what may happen with the new ones. Because if a organization has existing issues with many cyber squatting incidents on a monthly, weekly basis, then they're likely to have many more if you add 500 new top-level domains. If in fact they've had none up to now in top-level domains like .com and .net and .info and so on, I'm not sure it's realistic to believe that they will have problems when the new ones are released. So that's just, and I think we have to maybe focus on what has to be shown to indicate that there's harm.
Thank you, Jim. And that's the question that you just asked is exactly the question that I at least wanted to answer to ask. Maybe I haven't been clear enough, but the how do we evidence harm? What type of advice does the group offer in terms to get an answer to that question? What quantitative measures should we apply and try to get empirical data on to help us answer the question? That's exactly the type of discussion that I was trying to stimulate. And before I give the word to Ellen, let me share a secret with you. You know, as chair, my hope was that we might get rid of quantitative aspects to demonstrate or to discuss harm, because that would make our lives far easier. So if we had other parameters that we could be looking at, that might be much easier to even get consensus on. Because as we heard, you know, the sheer figure, a number of costs imposed on organizations are deemed high by some, are deemed low by others, are going to be sliced by those criticizing potential protections by saying, okay, these costs are relatively low. So there are difficulties with whatever quantitative parameters we come up with. And this is why I would like the group to discuss how we can fence that in. This is why I asked you to prioritize the points that are of relevance for you, and then maybe try to boil it down to parameters where we have an easier time coming up with facts and answering the question. Ellen, please.
Yeah, thank you. I recognize that some of the numbers that are going to come out of this kind of discussion are going to be hard to analyze, but I think Jim hit the nail on the head that at the extreme ends, they're not hard to analyze. We may have trouble deciding where the line of demarcation is, but an organization, and there are some because I found them easily, that have not felt the need to register a single defensive domain, and some of them are available, so they could have, clearly does not have the same level of problem as someone who has 300,000 domains. Now, yes, all of those aren't exact matches, but the parameters are just so different that we may not get a definitive answer by looking at metrics only, but they're going to start to show us the range of kinds of problems or lack of problems that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And you have indicated earlier that you're going to send some more information on this to the list?
Yeah, the research is taking me longer, and I've been diverted by a number of PDPs that have required statements in the last week or two. But unfortunately, this is not the only group.
Mm-hmm. But
you will be getting something from me, hopefully well before the next meeting.
Thanks, Alan. I think that, this was was a good starting point of an intense discussion about the merits of the individual points. Just to remind you, we've used this spreadsheet to bring the main parameters on the table, and now we need to look at the merit of the individual points and see which ones can be used better and which ones we might be able to kick off the list. So my request to you is to take a look at the issue of the nature of the problem and provide your input and your ideas to Robin, who is the leader of that subgroup, so that we can hopefully come up with at least some questions that we need to ask the organizations that are asking for protections to further inform our discussion. I would like to use the remaining time to talk about qualification criteria. So this is your last chance to comment on the nature of the problem issue before we move on. Okay, I see no hands up, so let's move on to the qualification criteria point. And there have been, I think the spreadsheet accurately reflects the arguments that have been made in the course of our discussions regarding qualification criteria. There are a few more points that we can take from the Alex statement, which Kieran might want to add to the spreadsheet later on. I'm particularly thinking of the point that has been highlighted by Alan during his presentation of the statement, and that is the point of to what extent does the organization in question actually correspond to users via the Internet. Alan, I hope that I'm not misrepresenting this point, but I think that at least that point is missing from the criteria spreadsheet today. When I analyzed the comments that have been made, I thought that we should discuss a little bit the very first point, because that caused some discussions already, and that is the criterion of protection by treaty. You will remember that during last week's call, we had a discussion about the remit of this group or the charter, and the question whether for organizations to be eligible we would need treaty protection and cumulative and protection in multiple jurisdictions. And this has been answered at least by some of the participants. I think it were the majority of participants who spoke up that said that those criteria need to be present cumulatively because of the history of the PDP, but also based on the documents that have been published both by the GAC and the ICANN board. But taking a closer look at it, I think the question or the criterion of the protection by treaty needs to be looked at more closely. Because we, you know, I'm not going to give a full report on the details of that, but there have been arguments like these that a certain treaty does not protect a certain name, like in the case of the IOC, where the five rings are protected as a signal, as a symbol, but not the word. Then another point was the protection granted by a treaty, or whether an organization needs to be needs to have been created under a treaty. So I think there is quite a lot of there are a lot of issues under this point that needs that need to be discussed, and I would like to use this this forum or this call to maybe elaborate on that a little bit further, because what I think is needed for the group to decide whether protection by treaty needs to be present inevitably, and if so, what type of treaty protection is needed, and if we need any additional parameters, then we would need to decide what parameters need to be present in addition to protection by treaty, whatever that might look like. Now that has been quite a broad of quite a broad question, but maybe there are participants in the group that are brave enough to kick off the discussion here. I saw a hand for a microsecond. No? Alan, please.
I think it may be stupid enough to kick off the discussion, not brave enough. I guess I want to see that kind of information also, but it's got to be real information, not hand-waving. And I'll give you an example, Anna, and forgive me, I'm directing it at one particular participant, and that's the Olympics. To say that various names are protected in multiple countries is not as helpful as saying we want this particular character string, because we're talking character strings here. That's what we're going to block or stop the use of or reserve. The real salient information is going to be this particular character string, specific characters, is protected in how many different countries. Simply saying that one of the many character strings is protected in 50 countries doesn't really say about how global the protection is for any given string and why we should do a global worldwide protection of it. And I think it's that level of specificity that is going to allow us to understand the nature of the problem and the nature of the remedies that we're proposing. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I suspect that seeing Kieran Sanders, Jim,
It's not. It's Kieran this time. Surprise.
Sorry for that. Kieran, please.
That's okay. Just in response to Alan's point, you know, we're working in a spreadsheet that has a cell that stops us from inputting a certain number of characters. But let me just clarify by saying that we say various names are protected in multiple countries. The strings that we're discussing, Olympic and Olympiad, are universally protected by all of the statutes that we cite in what we submitted to ICANN on multiple occasions over many years. The reason why we say various names are protected is because a vast majority of that legislation also protects things like Citius Altius Fortius, which is the motto of the Olympic movement. So we don't want to limit ourselves in general to try to misrepresent the statutes as only protecting the words Olympic and Olympiad, which are on the table here. We're happy to discuss the specifics, but we've already done so and then resubmitted and made that information available to this group. So you've seen a statute table, you've seen submissions from us in the form of letters, you've seen things come from the GAC, which we gave to them by their request. All of this has the information with a level of specificity about the statutes that we're citing. It's an enormous amount of paper, as you can imagine, and we can't put it in a spreadsheet. But we're happy to resend it to the group if you need it again. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Kieran. I'm not sure whether it's needed that you resend the documents to the group. You know, with this discussion, I rather wanted to spot some of the complexities that we faced. And before I give the floor to Alan, I'd like to ask Brian if Brian is still on the call. Brian, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Thomas.
Yeah, because Brian has been one of the drafters of the final issue of the issue report of this PDP, and he's quite extensively worked on the legal side of things. And in the preparation of this call, I had a chat with Brian because I was looking for, you know, maybe easier solutions that make it easier for the group to come up with answers. And he's in a much better position to maybe share of the complexities that he has faced during his research. So, Brian, could you help me out at this stage, please?
Sure. Although I don't know, Thomas, if you would find it be helpful to just provide a summary of some of the different, you know, positions that have been taken on this account, or I'm not. If you can guide me on what would be most helpful at this point for you. And
yes, I think that would be helpful. We've talked about different interpretations of treaties, also of potential limitations of the scope or the protection level of the treaties, and you know, maybe you could highlight a couple of points for the group.
Okay, sure. Well, I think the challenge here for the group and for whatever final policy determinations or recommendations are devised is that, as we've seen in the discussions here, you know, each group has advocated, you know, a certain level of treaty that provides protection. But again, as we've seen, there's been different interpretations of those treaties, whether it be the Nairobi Treaty for the IOC, and as is pointed out, and I, you know, I understand that there's the interpretation that, you know, making the connection between the actual protection for emblems versus the names of the IOC. The IGOs, of course, advocate that Article 6 of the Paris Convention protects their names, but I think it's well recognized that certain countries don't agree with that interpretation of automatic protection, and there are certain provisions within the Article 6 that indeed would limit that protection based on, you know, any unlikelihood of public confusion and or because, you know, limited the protection only when the use of those names are associated with the use of goods. So, you know, I think it's recognized that although each of the groups have treaties that they advocate as, you know, justifying the protection of their names, there are different interpretations among member countries involved. I think it's also important to point out that you know, there's the question of distinguishing between INGOs, such as the Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement of the IOC, and IGOs. And again, not that the PDP working group is bound by the GAC advice, but the GAC itself has taken different tacks. As we've talked about, the GAC has criteria for INGOs is basically protected by treaty and also domestic laws in multiple jurisdictions. As we've seen in the Toronto communique, the GAC has taken a different approach for IGOs, and rather than basing it based on the language of the Toronto communique, rather than basing criteria such as protection under Article 6 TER, they're looking at the criteria of the .int registration of a domain name. And if we look at that, it's not being protected by a treaty per se, but rather that the organization is created by a treaty and that the organization has a distinct international legal personality. So the criteria there, the GAC is leaning on, or kind of at least leaning towards, in terms of coming up with a list that it would recommend to protect for IGOs, is again not based on treaty protection of the IGO names, but rather that the IGOs or any organization would be established by a treaty, and again having a distinct international personality. So I think that's an important distinction to look at, perhaps as way moving forward in trying to determine what type of criteria, if you're looking at treaties and multiple jurisdictions, to move forward on in the discussions.
Thanks, Brian. That's very helpful. Are there any questions for Brian? Any comments? I have Lanre. Lanre, please.
Yes. Each time we talk about qualification of criteria, we seem to place a lot of emphasis on protection by treaty and protection by national law. But there are some INGOs that are doing a lot for public good that are neither covered by public treaty or national law. How do we accommodate them? For example, Oxfam and many other ones. I'm sure they also want to be protected. They also want their names protected. But they are neither protected by treaty or national law. And I think they also deserve some kind of consideration.
Thanks, Lanre. Lanre, I had a hard time understanding what you said because, at least for me, the line was not too good at times. Brian, if you could fully understand what Lanre said, maybe you would be as kind as to repeat the question and maybe give a response to that.
Sure, and Lanre, please correct me if I misunderstood. I also had a little bit of difficulty hearing, but I think if I understand you correctly is, you have certain INGOs such as Oxfam that would not fall within the criteria such as, being protected by an international treaty and also domestic laws in multiple jurisdictions, where if indeed those criteria were to be, to be maintained, what would happen, how would those type of organizations be considered for protection? Is that correct, Lonnie?
That's very correct.
Okay, thank you. This is, I think, one of the challenges the PDP working group has to deal with, and that is if indeed you maintain the criteria that has been set by the precedent, for example, of the previous New DLD PDP's work and or the GAC criteria that it was established to protect the IOC and Red Cross, Red Crescent names, indeed those types of organizations will probably not be able to qualify. And so that's something for this group to consider is, do you maybe change that criteria to an either or do you expand the criteria to allow for such organizations to be considered? I don't know if there's anything more I could say at that point, beyond that point.
Are there any more thoughts on that? Or let me put it the other way around, and maybe I can ask Jim and Kieran. Do you think we can discuss the treaty issue on the basis of the information that we have at present, or would we need to go into more detail there to come up with a sound answer?
Well, This is Kieran. I guess I don't understand what you mean by proceed on the basis of what information we have now.
Let me try to clarify. The qualification criterion, as it's now stated, is that it's called protection by treaty. And I have opened this up for discussion because following the discussion, particularly in the last week, but also before that, I'm not sure whether protection by treaty as a criterion as such will really help us solve the problem. The question is, wouldn't it be more appropriate to get to the details of that, and maybe say protection by treaty that created an organization or the beneficiary organization, or do we leave it at the protection level? You know, just to give two examples of how even the treaty criterion can be applied in different manners.
Well, Thomas, in our email from yesterday, which was directed towards Ricardo, but then also the entire group, I think the way that we advocated that the treaty would be used is similar to how the GAC used it, which I understand isn't precedential for this group, but might be at least helpful, which was that the evidence of a treaty supporting intellectual property of an organization shows that it has special international status and is worthy of protection, but may not necessarily direct specifically to the intellectual property that we're discussing in this group.
Yeah, I noted that in that email you used the word worthy. The word worthiness has also been used in the ALEC statement. Yet during last week's call, I think there was at least some agreement inside the group that it's not for the working group to decide which organizations are worthy and what not. So I have some difficulties understanding what the best approach for that might be. Greg.
Thank you. I think we've inherited the treaty criteria or criterion from our predecessor drafting team and from various efforts prior to this working group. I continue to think that it is a troublesome criteria, especially given as Brian pointed out, even if you assert that there is a treaty involved, there are arguments that can be made that the treaty may or may not apply, or it may apply in ways that are not so simple to parse out. And furthermore, and especially if we somehow come to the conclusion that Article 6 TER and the Paris Convention generally does not bring into the fold IGOs, then and certainly we have we'd have kind of the vast majority of IGOs and INGOs, certainly INGOs would tend to be excluded from this whole exercise, which I think would be a bizarre result. I think we can, there may be other reasons why, we would want to determine that some organizations should or should not be, given whatever protection we either ultimately decide to offer, if any, or that some may receive one level and some may receive others, but while a treaty may be indicative of a international stature of some sort, it's not an exhaustive or singular way to find that an organization has broad international reach and serves the public good and is a kind of whatever is an INGO that's not unworthy. For instance, Médecins Sans Frontières or Oxfam or WaterAid or whatever it may be, all could find themselves on the wrong side of the fence here. Whereas the accident, if you will, of having a treaty founding, you know, forming, which would be, you know, apply, I think, you know, almost, you know, may apply to IGOs fairly comprehensively, but apply to INGOs on a arbitrary and not very comprehensive basis at all. You know, really, I think it may just not be helpful at all to our to the exercise here. I know that we've kind of inherited it. I don't know, but I don't really think that, you know, living with it and using it to inform what our end result is here is going to result in a an end result, regardless of our conclusions, that, you know, will really look like it's been, you know, looked at with the kind of the right objective set of criteria. Thank you.
Greg, a quick follow-up question. What would your favorite criterion or set of criteria be?
I'd have to give that a little bit more consideration and review, you know, all the criteria that have been established. I think that certainly, you know, would look for criteria that would point to organizations that have broad international outreach, that are not merely functioning in a single country or a small group of countries, although you know, there are arguments given that, you know, a small group of countries could cover, you know, all of North America and Central America, whatever it might be, or all of North and South America. You know, kind of nose counting exercise, I think, is a dangerous one. But that you know, clearly, in our organizations that you know, have meet their own national criteria for being non-governmental organizations, that are, you know, international in scope, and that, you know, meet whether it may be the World Bank or United Nations definition of what an NGO is, you know, should be sufficient. What specific criteria we could use to kind of cut those out, and more importantly, I guess the other way to look at it is, you know, why do we want certain INGOs and IGOs to fail the criteria? What should be our, you know, look at it the other way around. Who do we want to fail? Why do we want to keep them out? What do we believe is, you know, puts an organization on the wrong side of the fence here? You know, if we're trying to exclude rather than include, which is, you know, is two sides of the same coin, but why do we want to exclude certain organizations, and what do we think makes them insufficiently or inappropriate for whatever protection we decide? And, you know, we're not just talking about blocking protections, but there may be other flavors of protections, and, you know, the question too is whether organizations will qualify automatically or will need to apply, such that many organizations may not care to apply or feel that it's worth, you know, looking into this issue. But I think that's kind of, you know, I realize that's somewhat vague, and I apologize, but I think that's kind of the sense of the criteria that I would be looking for, and also really trying to think about this from the other side of who are we keeping out and why. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. I think the idea of maybe introducing or at least discussing negative criteria is a good one. And may I encourage you to give this more thought and maybe come up with a proposal to the list. I have Alan.
Absolutely.
Next.
I think just to say that I'm not just thinking just of negative criteria, but just of also the idea of failing to meet positive criteria. So failing to meet a treaty or failing to have a treaty establishing you is not a negative criteria, but the question then becomes, why is that a criteria that if you meet it, it's you're in, and if you don't meet it, you're out? Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for that clarification. Greg, Ellen, please.
Yeah, I no longer remember why I put my hand up, but I like the way this discussion is going now. So I support it, and I think it's completely in line with the kind of suggestions that ALAC was making in its statement. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Alain?
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to, of course, independently of the what we do with the recommendation that organizations that would benefit from special protection would have to demonstrate the needs for protection. If we just go back to the international treaty requirements, that's pretty. It has its complications, but it's for IGOs, it's pretty straightforward. again, walking away from the discussion that, you know, why would there be automatic qualification criteria like that? But for INGOs of the type that we discussed before, like Amnesty International or the Conservation International or the Nature Conservancy, etc., very, very large, well-established, truly international organizations, it would be important to add the criteria, and I've made this argument before, of demonstrating that that organization possesses independent international legal personality. That is, the onus would be on the applicant to demonstrate that it has that personality, and in fact, it corresponds to it corresponds to qualification number three in the IANA eligibility qualification for an .int domain. I know they're not being effective right now, but that concept is would actually meet both the in other words, if the motivation of the applicant for special protection was high enough, he or she would have to justify the needs for protection as well as to meet that independent international legal personality. So, in a way, if we only leave treaties, then it unduly favors the public sector stakeholder in general, to the detriment of the private and or the not-for-profit stakeholder, as only governments can enter into treaties with other governments. So if we want a robust and balanced multi-stakeholder model, ICANN, then we try to get it into every little nook and cranny. And that's why I advocate in this qualification. The test of establishing that you possess independent international legal personality is extremely arduous to make. So you'd have to be really, really motivated, and it would. If passed, there would be little doubt that the applicant would be a very, very worthy, truly international organization. I believe, for instance, the Red Cross would have no difficulty, besides the arguments they already have, to establish an independent international legal personality. So I think if we are trying to limit the number of special protection, I don't know if that's an objective, then certainly this criteria would close the floodgates. And so I think that even very large national NGOs that work in 7 or 8 or 12 countries would not be able to establish an independent international legal personality at all. So maybe something worth thinking more about. I'm not a lawyer, so I rely on the lawyers to either confirm or denigrate this suggestion of for qualification.
Alain, thank you very much. Before I give the word to Kieran or Jim, let me ask you. Whether you have any views on the criteria for the other types of organizations. You know, you were referring to the INGOs. Do you have a view on the criteria or legal requirements for IGOs, IOC, and RCRC?
Sorry, what was the last part of your question, IGOs?
IGOs, IOC, and RCRC, which are the other fields in the spreadsheet that we're discussing?
Well, no, certainly less on I feel that international IGOs, there's a really a you know, there's a very limited number of treaties, and these are generally very large organizations, you know, like for instance Future Harvest, which used to be called the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. Well, you know, it's, there's a number of them, and they hold the key to the gene banks of all the key food that that feed the world, rice and cereals and potatoes, etc. And they have no difficulty in also meeting the criteria of the global public good that Stefan was referring to. But no, I've let my position known as an with my NPOC hat on in San Jose that we were in favor of the first level anyway, special protection for the Red Cross. And this was a matter of truly representing our members, since the Red Cross is an NPOC member. But I think I would limit my comments to the... I'm a little bit more confident that the independent international legal personality would be a balanced qualification for the larger NGOs. Now, do we want to favor larger NGOs in this process? That's another issue. So sorry to not have a crisp answer for you, Thomas.
Not to worry. Thank you, Alain. And I don't dare to guess whether it's Kieran or Jim now, so either of you please speak up.
Hi, Thomas, it's Kieran. I just wanted to clarify and respond to your comment a while ago about worthiness. I think what we meant to convey in the letter or the email from last night was that a treaty demonstrates a certain conclusion of the international community regarding the organization, which we believe is more valuable than a... And very different from what we had, maybe not more valuable, but very different from what this group was discussing in regard to value or worthiness, which was some sort of subjective consideration by this group of charitable value of an organization rather than kind of overall worthiness as some sort of protection, which would have included many variables. So I hope that clarifies that for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Kieran. That's indeed very helpful. I mean, if this group chose to even have worthiness as a criterion, we would need to make the best out of that. I was just spotting that during the last call, I got the impression more or less that worthiness is nothing for us to decide, and then the term at least showed up, but this was very helpful for you to provide us with, you know, with some more background information on.
I think that was a poor word choice on my part, and certainly not what we meant to convey, and we wanted to make sure that we separated our mistaken use of the word worthy in our discussion of the treaty with our general opposition to the criterion of charitable worthiness or charitable value, which we do oppose within the context of this group's considerations. Thanks.
Thank you, and I have Ellen.
Thank you. I just want to make something clear. I don't think anyone is suggesting, at least I hope not, that this group decide on worthiness of a particular organization. I think, and AILAC thinks, it is reasonable for this group to decide on what the parameters should be that someone then makes a decision on at a later time. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And talking about you, Alan, I'm certainly glad to hear that you like the way the conversation goes, because it picked up some of the ALEC points, and that is primarily because your group was the only group to provide a written statement so far. And there's no value judgment behind that, at least not from a chair's perspective. So had the other groups contributed in time, we might have been discussing the remit or the merits of their statements. Having said that, I'd like to encourage you again to provide input for this discussion. Certainly, at least to me, our discussion today has shown and still shows that the longer we discuss, the more questions pop up, and I think we need to make sure that we structure our work in a manner that allows us to come up with responses in a timely manner. Having said that, please do contribute to the specific or the various subgroups. I think it's of utmost relevance that you share your viewpoints with your colleagues. I think that will help us to advance our work and come to a conclusion or to consensus call earlier. In terms of next steps, as I mentioned earlier, I think the fact of, I see Chuck's hand up. Chuck, please.
Thanks, Thomas. I don't know if this is helpful or not. I think it would be helpful for me, but because of all the great input that is happening to all of the subgroups' work, it's becoming increasingly difficult to stay on top of everything. So I'm wondering whether it would be possible, it may not be, for each of the subgroups to try and consolidate, maybe abbreviate's a better word, the input that has been given. I'm not saying reach consensus. That's nice, but I doubt if it's going to be possible in a lot of cases. But if it would be helpful for each subgroup to abbreviate what they have, including all the input that's been given, so that we have a more concise look at where we're at. That doesn't mean we can't have more input, but I know I'm trying to track everybody's input, but it's really challenging.
And I couldn't agree more. Thank you very much, Chuck. That's very helpful. And as if you were reading my mind, my proposal in terms of the next step is that the subgroups would continue what I try to stimulate today, namely to prioritize the various points that have been discussed, maybe shortlist them by deleting some of the criteria or the arguments that you find less relevant, and then actually leave the Excel format and get to a report or Word document, or not Word document, but to a text document format that would allow us to put more substance in there. So the idea is not necessarily to get shorter in terms of characters, but to narrow the number of action items that we need to work on, narrow them down, and then where necessary, discuss the individual points in more depth, as is surely needed for the treaty question, for example. Can I get some views on that? Do you like the idea of amalgamating the spreadsheets into a more concise, in terms of points, document and continue our conversation on the basis of that? Let me ask the question the other way around. Is there any objection to proceeding that way? Seeing none, I'd like to proceed that way. I'm not sure whether it's feasible for us to have the text ready by next week. So I will try to highlight some of the points that need further discussion for next week's call, so that we can pick individual questions that we discuss in more depth. And then my proposal would be that we have sort of the interim report, if you wish, ready for for the call in 2 weeks. Barry and I will be working on the timeline in more detail that we will publish on the list. As regards next steps or the work plan, since there has been no objection to changing the format of our work, we will come up with a suggestion of an amended work plan between now and the next meeting. As you may know, there will be a GNSO Council call tomorrow, and we have decided, although there is no, although we didn't make substantial progress in terms of results or interim results, I will be allowed a 5-minute slot to discuss or to explain to the council what we're doing, what the status of our work is, and maybe encourage more people to participate. I see Stefan's hand up. Please, Stefan.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to ask a little bit how we will proceed with the other worksheets, because last week we didn't get to discuss worksheet to D, for example, and so are we concentrating at this stage on the criteria worksheet and the problem worksheet or the others as well? The reason I say this is, for example, in work package D, for example, on protections, today it came up, you know, that an exact match protection might not do it. This has appeared also in one of the written documents that was submitted. So I just, you know, I was just wondering, you know, when we will get to work package D, and it's a comment I wanted to make last week, which is, you know, would the string similarity review not fit into this, for example? That's a comment that I have. But I'm not quite sure, you know, when we will get to these elements or whether we settle the criteria question first. Thank you.
Stefan, that's something that I will take a closer look at. I have focused on the more controversial points and the points where I saw discussion on the mailing list regarding the eligibility. You may remember that we've parked that or shelved that project for the time being. But, and for admission and protections, I haven't seen any progress that we could discuss. So I would like to encourage you to feed your observations and comments into the protection subgroup, if you have any, and should there be the need to discuss, then you know, discussing the protections may be one of the questions that we put on next week's call's agenda. Is that okay for you?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Any more questions or recommendations, observations? Hearing and seeing none, it's 4 minutes to the hour, so I think we will be able to end this call even a little bit ahead of time. I thought that this was a very informative and interesting discussion, and I hope that you share this view. I'd like to thank you all for your patience and your expertise and your input. And again, please do communicate on the list. There's far too little traffic on the list to my liking. So please continue the good conversation. Keep up the momentum. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Operator, this is Barry. You can stop the recording.